The Tom Woods Show, episode 1260.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, learn the history and economics they kept from you over at libertyclassroom.com, my flagship site. Learn from me and from other folks you can trust all the stuff they left out. Check it out at libertyclassroom.com and grab yourself a coupon at libertyclassroom.com/coupons. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. Scott Horton is back. I decided to have Scott on because of a post somebody brought to my attention on a sort of libertarian Facebook page, and it was about the situation in Afghanistan, and it was contesting the claim that the U.S. has not done a good job there, or that the U.S. is somehow the bad guy there. To the contrary, conditions have improved considerably, and the population seems reasonably satisfied with the U.S., according to polling data, and according just to some statistics about the wealth in the country and the state of people's standard of living, let's say, and life expectancy and so forth. So I thought, well, who better to talk to you about that than Scott Horton, who is the author of Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan. You can check it out at foolserrand.us. Scott, of course, hosts The Scott Horton Show, where you will hear his brilliance on a regular basis. He is also the host of Anti-War Radio on KPFK 90.7 in Los Angeles. Follow him at scotthorton.org and libertarianinstitute.org. Scott, welcome back.
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
You know, I was about to say a few things about foreign policy in a talk I'm giving in a few days, and so I thought, well, what's the best way to brief myself on these issues? So I printed out the transcripts of our last conversations on this show, and okay, this is pretty much what I needed. Well, I thought of you.
I'm here for you, man.
I appreciate that. I know that. I thought of you as soon as I saw this post on a, I guess, a sort of—
Wait, before we talk about that, let's talk about my book.
Oh, but this whole do you want to talk about your
Wait, a year ago, I published my book, Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan.
Yep.
And you told me that if I sold 2,000 of them, that would be a successful nonfiction book, right?
Yeah.
Or like for a political nonfiction book.
Especially self-published.
I don't know if you count the audiobooks or not.
You should.
It's 3,000 books. It's 4,000 if you count the audiobooks, and probably 5 if you count all the ones I've sold myself at different events and that kind of thing. So that's pretty good, right?
That is pretty good. Absolutely. Now,
did I tell you I got a brand new one coming out?
You sure did. And I love the brilliant way you went about it. If I were you, you know what? You could go either way. Yeah. Do you want to talk to people about it? Because it's the book everybody needs.
Yeah, well, it's going to be a while. I have to edit it severely. But yeah, I promise I would never write a book again because it was terrible.
It's awful.
I hated writing
a
book.
Worst
it was
thing.
So hard.
And
took
people have
so
no
long.
Idea how awful it
I
is.
I can't do one thing for that long in a row, you know?
Yeah, jeez.
But so I got this great scam. I did a presentation for Thaddeus Russell's Renegade University back in February. And I've got this wonderful transcriptionist, Joanne, and she went and sat through this 5-hour PowerPoint lecture that I did, which is still available for sale at Renegade University, by the way. But she transcribed the entire thing. And it's basically, it was the book you and I were going to write in the first place, a brief take on all of the terror wars, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, Libya, Mali, Syria, Iraq War 3, and then, you know, now a bit on Iran. It's all there. So now I just have to edit the hell out of it for the next, I don't know, a few months until it is good enough.
But that's so much easier than writing from scratch. Editing your, your spoken
word. I mean, basically
word.
I got the whole first draft done for free. It was like it was ghostwritten for me, but it was my words in the first place, so it's totally cool.
Yeah, that's really, really great. I can't wait for that. And yeah. And folks,
the working title is, God dang it, Bobby, time to end the war on terrorism.
There you go. All right, look, folks, so we're going to get into something interesting in just a second. I want to make sure you all are getting, I know you say, I have a lot of books, but when you see Fool's Errand, you're going to look at Scott on like a whole new level. You already think Scott has so much in his brain, I don't know how he fits it all in there. But then you see the way he presents it so systematically and footnoted and everything. You say, how could Scott be better than I thought he was? It's like Judge Napolitano. You think, hey, he's a great guy. But then you see him lecture at the Mises Institute, and he's walking around the room, and he knows all these cases off the top of his head. You say, whoa, wow. This guy's
there's a comparison I will accept.
Yeah, there you go.
Gratefully, thank you. Yeah.
Yeah, no problem. All right, let me read. I'm going to actually read for the listening audience this entire post. Not that long, just to contextualize everything we're going to say here. This is a post on a Facebook page called Being Classically Liberal. And it goes like this. And you'll immediately see why I thought of Scott when I read this. Thoughts on the war in Afghanistan. The left and many libertarians, I think that may be you, Scott, like to denounce the war in Afghanistan and act like it is a complete failure. Some of those criticisms are very fair, others not so much. Many portray America as an unwelcome aggressor, and the insurgents who fight us are portrayed as reasonable people defending their homeland. This is an anti-American fantasy. I urge anyone who isn't strapped into an ideological straitjacket to reconsider such positions. If you look at the facts, Afghanistan is far better off after American-led regime change. According to the Asia Foundation, today, expected educational attainment at birth is 10.1 years compared to 2.5 years in 2000 under the Taliban. In 2002, Afghanistan had just 1 million students. Today, it has 8.7 million, 39% of them female. Life expectancy at birth has increased from 45.3 years in 2000 to 60.7 years in 2017. From 1960 until 2001, Afghanistan's national income never exceeded $4 billion. They were incredibly, incredibly poor. But since America invaded and started nation building in 2001, Afghanistan's national income has jumped remarkably from under $2.5 billion in 2001 to over $20 billion in 2017, according to data from the World Bank. To see whether or not nation building has failed, perhaps we should ask what the Afghans themselves think. According to the Afghan Center for Socioeconomic and Opinion Research, over 90% prefer their flawed but democratic government over the Taliban. Moreover, 76% support the presence of American troops, and 8 in 10 say it was a good thing for the United States to oust the Taliban in 2001. Ponder that for a moment. 80% of Afghans believe American-led regime change was a good thing. That is completely the opposite of the narrative that anti-imperialist academics and scholars like Noam Chomsky have spoon-fed you. So you see what I thought about Scott when I looked at that? So, Scott, let's see. There are a lot of different points raised there. What do you think is the most sensible one to start with?
Well, I mean, for me, the first thing is that the U.S. government has no right to occupy Afghanistan, to do anything for or against anyone there at all. And they don't have the right to one taxed dollar of the American people in order to do that either. So there are a lot of, you know, questions being begged here and premises being assumed about, you know, as if all of his, you know, facts were correct, which they're not, but if they all were, just what that's supposed to amount to. You know, the Israelis want to stay on American welfare. In fact, Tom, everyone in the world who collects a welfare check from Uncle Sam wants to continue doing it, whether you're talking about literally, you know, CHIP or this kind of thing, or whether you're talking about subsidies for massive oil companies or telecommunications firms or the English or whatever it is. Whoever's tab Uncle Sam is picking up wants to keep it that way. So polling them and saying, well, that's what they want is, you know, questionable whether that's kind of meaningful at all to me. And then, you know, when any poll number says 92% is for something like this, a population, 92% of a foreign population. That wasn't the occupation. 92 was they support the current government. I mean, I don't think that you can get 92% to agree what day of the week it is. You know, any poll like that to me is obviously suspect. But then, you know, if it's true, I thought of the old joke about, you know, like the right wing militia guys say, hey, it only takes 3% to wage a successful revolution. Well, I guess, you know what, if they have that kind of consensus for the current state and yet somehow the Taliban control, you know, 50% of the country in the daytime and 65% at night or something like that. Boy, what an insurgency that is. And of course, you know, the Taliban, they are, and the insurgency, the broad-based Pashtun insurgency, they are Afghans. It's not like they're a foreign army invading from outer space or even from Pakistan. They have safe haven in Pakistan, but they're Afghans. They are the uncles and brothers and fathers and sons of Pashtunistan in the south and east of the country. So you know, I have a hard time believing. And you know what? Maybe it's true that these NGOs really did good jobs surveying. I didn't have time to look through the PDF files of all the surveys that he linked to. But the national government has had no ability to win over the hearts and minds of those people and to, you know, instill governance in their areas of the country this whole time. So if 92% of the population support those efforts, then what's the problem? So this goes to another thing. And to bolster the credibility of the polling here, I think, I don't know about no 92%, but if you told me that a sound majority prefer the current situation to the Taliban taking over the country, well, that makes perfect sense. As I've explained to you on the show and explained in the book, a big part of the reason why the Afghan war can never quote unquote work, no matter what, is because the Pashtuns are a plurality of the country, about 40%. And the basis of the government is the Northern Alliance, which is combined together, it's 60% of the country. The Hazaras, Uzbeks, Tajiks, and then there are Turkmen and all different other, you know, minorities as well. Combined, they make up about 60%. And so they're still on a quest, though, backed by the U.S., to try to conquer that 40% of the Pashtun population there and force them to accept this government, and they just won't. So if you told me a majority of the country, you know, it's sort of like Florida, New York, and California all voted for Hillary Clinton, but a lot of the United States did not, but the major population centers did, and she won the popular vote for that reason, right? But that doesn't mean, well, in fact, if she had won, I think you might have seen some red states secede. They just, you know, I don't know. That's an extreme example. But you see what I mean, that the fact that you can cite some simple majority on paper doesn't go to show, you know, the opinions of the people where they are. And, you know, of course, in Nangarhar province in the east, and then especially down in Helmand province and Kandahar province, in these predominantly Pashtun areas, the Afghan government has never had control over those areas at all. And I'm sorry, I'm kind of rambling on, but I got a lot on my notes here.
No, I know you do. I know you do. Let me actually throw you a curveball a little bit and ask you something that's not in what I just read, and then we'll go through that stuff systematically. But the author of what I read to everybody followed up with another comment later saying, if you say we want to just cut and run, we just want to withdraw, you have to realize that you're turning the country back over to the Taliban and it will become a haven for terrorists again. Now, we've been hearing this argument for years and years and years. What's the Scott Horton reply?
Well, for the safe haven thing, I wrote an article about that for the American Conservative, if anybody wants to look at it. Let's get back to the safe haven myth thing in a second. But as far as the Taliban will take back over again, that if we leave now, that everything will fall apart, I agree with that entirely. But that proves that I'm right, that we have to go. It's just like Ron Paul says, bring on the recession, right? You're Austrian. If the U.S. government has completely distorted the economics of politics in Afghanistan, then what we need is a correction. What we need is to stop inflating the power of these and those chosen groups in the political economy there and let the chips fall where they may. That's the only way to have a sustainable war. You know, I was talking about the plurality and the majority and this and that. In Iraq War II, when they started that war, Baghdad was a mixed city. But look, 60% of the country were Shiite Arabs. And once George Bush took their side in the civil war, there was no question that eventually they were going to win. I mean, the Kurds were kind of out of it, way up in the north and out of the way and in alliance with the Shiites. But they were at war against the Sunni Arab 20% minority. And there was no question at the end of the day, that mission would be accomplished for what it's worth, right? That there was an end to that story where they could call it a day and go. I mean, they came back because Obama supported Al-Qaeda in Syria, but that's different. But so in this case, that's just, it can't happen, right? The mathematics aren't there for the northern tribes to rule the whole country. They're just never going to be. And so, yes, when America leaves, there's going to be a crash. There are major distortions of power there. And now, you know, when it comes to the Taliban taking over Kabul, let's remember that Bill Clinton's government in the 1990s, the United States of America supported the rise of the Taliban and worked with the Saudis and the Pakistanis to put the Taliban in power in the first place. You know, when he talks about, you know, GDP has improved, and we're going to crack those numbers in a minute. But when he talks about overall quality of life has improved for people, at least in certain parts of the country, Walter Block shouts, compared to what? Well, compared to what is they had a communist dictatorship, and then America backed the Mujahideen holy warrior fighters in the 1980s that provoked a Soviet invasion, a full-scale invasion that cost the lives of a million people. The communists killed a million people in that 1980s war, raised that entire society to the ground. And then when the Soviet Union fell apart and they left, all of America's most heroic Mujahideen warriors, the CIA's pets, like Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, who liked to skin his victims alive, they all went to war with each other, fighting over who was going to control the country. And it was a massive and bloody civil war, and the entire country was simply just divided by criminal warlords in every case. So in 1994, the Taliban religious authorities then were finally literally in the most grassroots assemblage of power you could kind of imagine, really. They started by people begged them to go and rescue some women and children who had been kidnapped and were being raped by the local warlords in Kandahar City. And the Taliban went and freed them, and everybody rallied around them. So they kept on going from town to town, liberating the people from their local criminal warlords, and liberated, you know, much of Pashtunistan, the south and east of the country, in short order. And then the Saudis and the Pakistanis and with American blessing, didn't just support them kicking the warlords out of the Pashtun areas, but the Clinton administration specifically wanted them to take over the whole country and to win the civil war, not to have a peace negotiation with their enemies, but to win the war outright, because they wanted that true monopoly state so that they could try to build their pipeline from Turkmenistan down to the port of Karachi, which is a fantasy anyway. But that was why America supported the rise of the Taliban in the first place. And all things being equal, at least they believed in law and order. They were absolutely authoritarian and medieval goons, but they weren't, I mean, and overall, you know, their government was corrupt because it was a government, but they didn't tolerate, you know, outright corruption on the lower levels of their deputies and so forth. You know, they brought law and order and put criminals, you know, to the sword. And so that was, you know, a big part of how they came to power, huge part of how they came to power. And then it's also worth remembering, and as I show in my book, and really all hail Anand Gopal for doing the very best work on this, that when America invaded, Tom, the Taliban gave up power very quickly. They did not say, this will be the mother of all battles and we will fight you forever and we will win and this and that. They left. And when America installed a Pashtun warlord from Kandahar province, Hamid Karzai, to be the new president, they recognized his government as Islamic and legitimate. And they retired the field and they did not fight. And they weren't the ones who attacked us. It was Al-Qaeda, and that's different. The Taliban didn't want to fight. It took until 2005 when people say that, oh, it's because Bush took all the troops and focused on Iraq. That's not it. It's because he left troops there and the troops kept finding things to do, finding enemies to make because, hey, they're Rangers. What are they going to do? Sit around with no enemies? So they went out looking for bad guys, and we supported a government that said, look over there, or, you know, that was made up of people who would say, look over there, the Taliban enemy, years after there was no such thing anymore. And look, terrorists and the American GIs and whoever, Marines, would go and pick new fights and create new enemies. And it wasn't really until 2005 that the Taliban, that the broad-based Pashtun insurgency led by the Taliban finally grew up to resist. And at that point, it was too late. It was an insurgency way too big for the Americans to destroy, you know. And I'm not saying that the Americans ever succeeded in foisting the national government on the South, but there was no insurgency against them for the first 4 years of the occupation until they picked a fight that they couldn't win. So, and then yes, when if America leaves now, the Taliban, they might just march on Kabul again. I mean, if they're stupid, they absolutely should not. Right. I mean, if they're smart at all, what they should do is learn from recent experience of their own and then the people who took over after them. that what would be better would be some significant autonomy and some live and let live policies for the different factions in the country who, you know, the different ethnicities are also geographically divided from each other very much. And so they should just, you know, leave well enough alone or take what they have now. But they absolutely are in a position of strategic strength. I mean, they control, as you know, the New York Times was admitting, the Wall Street Journal and, of course, the United Nations and whoever have done all these counts to show that they control better than half of the country, and including, you know, places far up in the north. Just last month, there was a massive attack on the city of Ghazni, just south of the capital of Kabul. That was like a mini Tet offensive where they went in there and took over, and they've been killing policemen and soldiers in record numbers, which in fact, numbers, there's a segue. The Afghan National Army costs $4 billion a year. Okay. But that's a fifth of the entire gross domestic product of Afghanistan. The national government can only pay $300 million toward that army, a $4 billion army. Their government can only pay $300 million towards it. So that's one fifth of their annual revenue, which is less than $2 billion a year. It's almost $2 billion, is their entire annual revenue for the national government. You know, that comes from domestic sources as opposed to just being dumped on them from the so-called international community, meaning you and me. Let me jump in here for a second.
Because
if America was gone, the thing would vanish overnight.
Well, that's
an Afghan army that's losing already as it is.
Well, to lend support to what you're saying, you sent me a piece, part of which is from the New York Times, part of which goes through what the U.S. government has been saying about recent events in Afghanistan, and then contrast that with what New York Times reporting has been saying. Now, it's pretty bad. We got to rely on the New York Times to tell us the truth here. But for example, this is not at all unusual. What they've done in this article is they've just shown us, here's what happened according to the U.S. government and according to us on August 10th, then August 11th, 12th, 13th, 14th. And it's eerie. It's Orwellian. So we have on August 11th, the Afghan government says it's in control of Ghazni. The U.S. says the city was relatively quiet Friday evening. Clearing operations are ongoing. The New York Times says Taliban were seen in control of every city intersection. Okay, then day three, August 12th, we read, according to the Colonel O'Donnell, we get the Afghan government continued to hold their ground and maintain control of all government centers. Tactically, operationally, and strategically, they achieved nothing with this failed attack. Well, the New York Times reporting was the Taliban appeared to be in control of most of the city. More than 100 Afghan police officers and soldiers are confirmed dead. Then we get Ghazni city remains under Afghan government control. The isolated and disparate Taliban forces remaining in the city do not pose a threat, etc. Then we read from the New York Times, Taliban insurgents took over most of the rural areas of Ghazni province, even as they battled over control of the provincial capital. And then it just continues like that.
Right. And now, listen, they never seize the provincial capitals because that's a good way to get B1 bombed off the face of the earth, right? They only ever do this temporarily, then they withdraw. It's always making a point. So think about that, too, like the impact of the Ghazni thing. You know, the Tet Offensive, famously, during the Tet Offensive in Vietnam, the Americans won every battle, right? The NVA and the South Vietnamese guerrillas got creamed, but they won the PR stunt anyway because they had attacked in so many different places at the same time, just after the American military had been saying they had the whole thing almost wrapped up. And so it didn't matter that they lost the tactical battles. It mattered that they won strategically with the move. Well, here they actually won. They actually seized the city for days and days and days. But they lost the PR stunt because no one cares. No one's even paying attention at all. What if they gave a Tet Offensive and nobody even reported it or cared, you know, or they just went with, yeah, no big deal. These things happen. And then, of course, yeah, they did withdraw because what? Because it took American air power, B-1 bombers that are made for delivering H-bombs to Moscow, supposedly, is how, you know, they forced your dad to pay for these things in a previous generation. They send the B-1s out to bomb them, and then they finally withdraw. You know, it's amazing that to think that, especially when we know that the president actually agrees that he's still the one behind continuing and carrying out this policy. And by the way, there, as long as we're off the numbers and talking about the news here for a minute, there's a brand new report out that we have linked at antiwar.com about civilian deaths. It's a new UN report about civilian deaths. And this is because Donald Trump has just completely taken the gloves off on the airstrikes over the past 2 years. And so there's, you know, already 8,000 casualties. I'm not sure how many of those are deaths versus woundings there, but that's just for this year. And the number of airstrikes are up far more than at any time since 2011 at the height of the Obama surge. And you know what? Let me go off on this tangent for 1 second. The excuse for the surge was they had to do counterinsurgency so they could get massive numbers, just a flood of U.S. infantry on the ground so that they would know everything that was going on and they would have good intelligence and they would be able to then help the leadership decide who's best to kill with these drones. So they would only be killing bad guys, not killing innocent people and driving more people into the arms of the insurgency. And Mike Flynn, famously Donald Trump's first national security advisor, he was Stanley McChrystal's right-hand man and head of intelligence during that time. And he ridiculed airstrikes without counterinsurgency as mere anti-insurgency, which he said is stupid and counterproductive and horrible and wasteful and can never work. Because what are you doing? You're bombing blind. You don't know who you're killing. You're killing people based on whose phone number called whose phone number. And Gareth Porter, of course, the American hero, winner of the Gellhorn Prize for his work. He won the Gellhorn Prize for his work on this question of how do they decide who they're bombing in these airstrikes, in the night raids, and in the drone strikes. And it's all just a bunch of nonsense. It's the kind of thing that if they told you to your straight face, yeah, this is intelligence, you would just laugh. This is intelligence. This SIM card is tied to this SIM card is tied to this SIM card. And this guy was there one time. We killed some other innocent guy. So they're all guilty. And this kind of thing, it's absolutely crazy. You know, it's you know, literally in a world, in an entire planet where people are connected by 6 degrees to Seven Bacon, not just other actors, but everyone in the world is connected by 6 or 7 degrees. Even Pashtun tribesmen are connected by 6 or 7 degrees to everyone else on the planet. And they'll use this kind of link analysis, network science, they call it, where basically they're outsourcing knowledge to a computer that spits out guilty and innocent as though it can know. And so, yeah, you wonder why they hate us. You wonder why the insurgency is doing so well. It's what McChrystal himself called insurgent math. For every one of them you kill, never even mind killing innocent people. Even when you kill a fighter, you get 10 more. Because that's somebody's brother. He's not really an army soldier. He's somebody's brother who picked up a rifle and joined the local militia. And so you kill him, now his brother and his cousin are in on it too. And on it goes this whole time. That's according to McChrystal. According to Petraeus, quite contrary to this Facebook post here, the people certainly of Pashtunistan, specifically Petraeus himself, said they prefer the Taliban's court system. Their civil and criminal, you know, systems of dispute resolution are far superior to a bunch of American-backed, corrupt, so-called judges from some alien system from the way that they do things there. And so, you know, it is a matter of demand that who do you want to settle your dispute with, your neighbor or whatever it is? The people of the Pashtun regions, the predominantly Pashtun regions of Afghanistan, prefer the Taliban. And by the way, the Taliban are the perfect symbol, I'm not denying it either, of, you know, basically a bunch of medieval, you know, I want to say cavemen almost, you know, I mean, certainly medieval, you know, ignorant pre-enlightenment, pre-modern thinking, backwards ass, you know, hooligans and heathens themselves to a large degree. But guess what? Compared to the traditional Pashtun ways, they're a bunch of flaming liberals, right? Like Tom, we would agree that the most important question in terms of the rights of human women is whether they can own property or not. Well, under the Pashtun Wali code, they can't. But under Islamic law, as interpreted, and they're not Saudi Wahhabists, they're Hanafis, is the kind of Sunni Islam that the Taliban practice. Under their Islam, Muhammad says, of course they can own property, and it's the duty of the state to protect their property rights. And, you know, that is all important right number one. Everything else, you know, secondary. Oh, which also reminds me of, as I say in the book, the Afghan police and military forces that the U.S. support there, the police forces there, according to the journalist Ann Jones, they spend more of their time chasing, kidnapping, basically, as slave catchers, running down runaway women and girls than any other thing. That is their main job in the country. That's what the Americans are paying for. You talk about rape culture. Afghanistan is actually a rape culture. And yeah, real bad. And that's what our government does, is our government pays the people who work for their government, whose job it is to kidnap these people and bring them back to their owners.
Scott, let's turn to some of those numbers. Now, in particular, they're saying that over the past, you know, X number of years, we've seen an increase of over 15 years in average life expectancy in Afghanistan. It turns out this ain't so. Now, what's the real truth of the story?
Yeah, well, so, I mean, first and foremost, on this specific point, the New York Times themselves in this recent piece, how the U.S. government misleads the public on Afghanistan that you were quoting from before. The U.S. government says life expectancy is 63 years. As you said, the CIA doesn't even agree with that. They say, no, it's only 51. The health researchers say it's 48. Life expectancy is 48 years. So it's really just propaganda.
Yeah. So you think, oh, well, I see these statistics published somewhere, and then you just drop your critical apparatus.
Right. And in fact, I'm surprised by that because, you know, again, back to what I was saying, where, you know, you had communists, then you had the Reagan era wars, then you had the Clinton era civil wars, and then the rise of the Taliban. There was a massive famine and drought in the late 1990s. Then, you know, the American war came, and of course, they defeated the Taliban and drove them out of power almost immediately. They didn't have a real insurgency to fight, as I said, for about 5 years there. And so, and even then, almost all of that has taken place in the south and the east of the country over these years since then. And so life expectancy in the north should, I guess, have done a lot better than this would indicate, I would think. I mean, the guy says, okay, look, there are more schools than ever. That's true. But the American Special Inspector General for Iraqi Reconstruction says that he has no evidence that American, you know, involvement in that is responsible for any of that. There's whatever American efforts have been made for building schools have been a complete joke. They collapse in the rain. They're built way out in the middle of nowhere. No electricity, no way to get to them. You know, they're ridiculous government projects, U.S. government projects on the far side of the planet, you know?
Yeah. But couldn't they say that on the other hand, if it hadn't been for the removal of the Taliban, these schools wouldn't have been built one way or the other?
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm not saying that the Taliban had a great, you know, progressive regime. On the other hand, you know, if the Americans had just said, hey, your victory is actually the success of our policy that we kind of were pushing in the first place. If George Bush had negotiated in good faith for al-Qaeda and avoided the war back in 2001 and said, you know, just like I think the policy should be, whether we're talking about Nixon shaking hands with Mao or Donald Trump shaking hands with Kim or anything, we ought to, the internal affairs of other countries is none of our government's business. Our government ought to, you know, seek to have peaceful relationships with all, entangling alliances with none. And so if the Taliban regime had won, I'm not saying I support Bill Clinton's policy, but I'm just saying if George Bush had said, okay, well, here's where we are with it, and had just tried to deal with them, and tried to integrate them into international trading systems and whatever is as good as possible. I mean, who knows? I mean, implied there is not 17 years of war. And, you know, but the Taliban, yeah, look, I mean, their idea of the way things should be is not too futuristic, man. So, you know, what all their goals would have been, nobody can really say. I mean, I mean, when he says, look, their GDP has gone up to 20 billion, I'm saying, yeah, I mean, again, just they lived under communism and total war. So they were coming up from nothing. But to 20 billion is not very much, you know?
Yeah. So in other words, what's happening here is what happens in so many cases where there's an already existing trend, or you take people starting at a ridiculously low baseline from which there's only one direction they can go, and that's up.
Right.
And then you give the state the credit for it.
And by the way, 3 billion of that GDP, 3 billion a year of that is heroin.
Not that there's anything wrong with
that. I'm not good at percentages, but that's a lot.
Yeah. No kidding. But on the other hand, when you read these statistics about 76% support the presence of American troops, 8 in 10 say it was a good thing for the U.S. to oust the Taliban, does that make it seem weird then for American anti-war activists to be anti-war when the people who are on the receiving end of the war are saying, no, actually, we're good with it?
Yeah, well, of course, you know, the people is too broad of a statement. Assuming the premise of those numbers, and I think they must be highly inflated, but assuming that, I mean, that reflects the fact that we have put them in a very bad position, that they know that if we leave, that there's hell to pay, that the Taliban not only are going to control the predominantly Pashtun regions, but they just might march on Kabul. They just might end up taking the whole country. At the time that America invaded in 2001, the Northern Alliance only held about 10% of the land up in the very northwest of the country. And they're, you know, they were almost defeated at that point. And the Taliban are, you know, as again, as a direct result of U.S. policies, are on the rise. In fact, you know, as I show in the book, there's an entire book about this. Unfortunately, I didn't realize that until after I wrote my book. But there was an American soldier wrote an entire book about the fact that America finances the Taliban to the tune of tens of millions of dollars a year, maybe more, every year. America hires the Taliban, pays taxes, outright state, not just gangster protection money, quote unquote, but quote unquote legitimate taxes to the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan, the Taliban's government, their shadow government in Afghanistan. The U.S. pays them taxes to protect our convoys on the roads out there. You know, the Marines are landlocked way the hell out in Helmand Province. The Rangers and Green Berets, or I guess it's the Green Berets, out there in Nangarhar, who can get them supplies unless you're paying the enemy the whole time? You know, they say that the Taliban have night vision goggles now. Uh-huh. And where do you think they got those? From forward operating bases that the Americans left behind. Wherever the American surge withdrew, the Taliban came right back again. It's their land. Again, they're not invaders from space. It's their land.
There's something screwy about the story that's being told here, because if it's true, if these numbers are true, that over 90% of Afghans prefer the regime, the government they have now, wherever it's powerful, over the Taliban, how could it be simultaneously the case that in just a second from now, the Taliban could completely take over and dominate the whole place? I mean, it seems to me it would be at least somewhat tricky for them to do that.
Well, look, the last two times they held elections there, they didn't even hold them out in the countryside at all. And they can't even hold an election. So how in the world do they do this level of polling all over the country in a reliable way? And what Afghan in a state of, you know, terror and war unending for 40 years in large part because of the USA here, which of them say anything other to the pollster other than, yes, I absolutely prefer the way things are now. Thank you very much. You know, there's an anecdote, I think, from Anand Gopal where they go, hey, there's an election. We're trying to register you for an election. And the reaction is, what, did the guy die? No, the guy didn't die. We're just having an election. Well, why would we have an election if the guy's still there? Like, they have no idea. Why would you screw with well enough? If a change of power to them means a very high chance of violence. So just leave everything the way it is, please, compared to God knows what might happen. And that's over an election for mayor, right? So assuming these numbers are right at all, assuming that they had real access to, you know, whoever it was, enough people in enough different places to get these numbers, I mean, you know, polls say a lot of things and poll respondents say a lot of things, and especially in those circumstances. And again, the Taliban are not the majority. The Pashtuns are not the majority of the country. They're just such a significant. They are the plurality. They're such a big plurality, 40%. So 60%, if you told me that all 60% of everyone who's not a Pashtun don't want to be ruled by the Taliban, and you told me another big percentage of Pashtuns wish that they had an alternative to them as well, then I wouldn't dispute that. I mean, that sounds right to me. It's just sort of beside the point, right?
Well, I don't want to look, I don't know any of the circumstances. I'm just guessing, but I would think also, probably, most people in Afghanistan don't have a lot of experience with the very institution of polling. And even in the U.S., if somebody comes up to me and says, how do you feel about X? Frankly, I'm not sure what to tell them half the time,
yeah.
Right?
I mean, so, in on one hand, you can't really take it the poll seriously. But on the other hand, I don't want to sound like I'm too dismissive of that.
No, exactly.
And right. Saying, I don't want to make it sound like the Taliban, as this guy says,
exactly.
This guy in the Facebook post says it, you know, the other point of view is that all of the insurgents are very reasonable people. Or something, you know, I'm not trying to say that. Of course, you know, they kill innocent civilians all day long. They're not innocent. They're not reasonable just because it is reasonable to see why they fight and that they have a reason for resisting in the first place doesn't mean that necessarily they're good men to a man. That's not the question. That's kind of a bait and switch. And by the way, he cites Noam Chomsky. But I've never heard of Noam Chomsky saying that every Afghan wants us to leave or something like that. He's just trying to say you're a communist if you don't think this or that. But you know what? And Noam Chomsky believes things that I don't believe about the way things should be or whatever. But his facts aren't all screwy. He's not the kind of guy who would make ridiculous statements about every Afghan wants us out of there. You know, there are people, again, who would be, tell me if you've ever heard of this one, Tom. Builders like inflation and they worry when the interest rates start going up. You know, they don't want the government to stop funneling liquid cash money into real estate markets, you know, but that doesn't mean that we get to let them decide what it is. You know, eventually we got to have that crash. And so that's the case here. And this is why I think, you know, Donald Trump, absolutely, when he came in, we know he said for years how much he was against this war. And all he had to do, and I think it's still not too late. It may be for another politician, but not for Donald Trump. He could just come out and say, this is all Bush and Obama's fault. Okay. They made the Pashtun tribesmen of Afghanistan our enemy, but that's stupid. They're really not. And I don't want to fight them anymore. And stupid Bush and weak loser Obama, they built this government in Kabul that cannot stand on its own. And the cost of trying to figure out a way to tie up these loose ends and create some soft landing that makes everything okay there is untenable and too expensive. It can't be done, not at a reasonable price. And so blame Bush, blame Obama, and you know what? Blame McMaster. I gave his plan a year, and that didn't work. He could do it right now. The McMaster plan didn't work. It's not going to work. But you know what? And let me work this in, because I know you like to keep your show short, and I'm already way over time. And I got so many other things to say about this subject, but I want to point out that none of this has to do with helping the damn people of Afghanistan at all. Now, the entire premise of our conversation is totally wrong here. You know, why is America in Afghanistan? Because China is east of there and Russia's to the north, Iran to the west. America's there because of strategery in the American quest for global domination. Iran, Russia, and China are three, really the last three major holdouts for American total hegemony. And whereas you and I might look at American presence in Afghanistan as a potential tripwire for a war we would like to avoid, right? Why share a border with Iran? If our government hates Iran so much, shouldn't we like keep a healthy distance from them, like stay in North America, leave them the hell alone, something like that? And same thing for Russia and China. And, you know, you're hearing more and more propaganda, true and false, I'm sure, about the oppression of the Uyghur Muslims in Western China, in the Xinjiang province there. And I want to point out that Eric Margolyes, the great journalist who I know you know as well, he's told me personally in 2001, in the summer before 9/11, he saw CIA training camps in Afghanistan where they were training Uyghurs to fight against the Chinese. And I believe that some of these men were the very same Uyghurs who were then rounded up and held in Guantanamo Bay and tortured and treated so inhumanely as, you know, bin Ladenite jihadists. And now, you know, potentially, you know, I think there's some sketchy reporting about this. I'd like to know more. I shouldn't say sketchy. I don't want to talk bad about anybody. I don't know enough about it yet, but there are some indications that this is back on. that the CIA, you know, would seek right now to use the Uyghurs to, you know, energize their insurgency against the Chinese to block what any real libertarian ought to consider the greatest invention in the history of mankind. And that is a single highway, railroad, fiber optic, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, highway between Shanghai and Lisbon, to create international trade beyond, you know, any limits through all of Eurasia. And that's the Chinese Belt and Road Initiative. And to the Americans, I just think of the arrogance. Just think of how stupid and wrong this is on the face of it, that this project threatens North American hegemony in Central Asia. This is no secret. This is no conspiracy theory. This is from, you know, Zbigniew Brzezinski and the Grand Chessboard all the way through. You can read it in Foreign Affairs this year, where they say, that's why we're here. And they, I quote them in my book, too, from Foreign Affairs from 2017, saying, you know, we're here for China. And so we do have a problem with this insurgency here. And the longer we stay, the more they hate us. Not the more they like us, not the more success we have. But we have to stay because China. We have to stay because we have the Bagram Air Base. And what are you saying? Give it up? No way. And you know what? I talked with Larry Wilkerson, who was Colin Powell's chief of staff when Colin Powell was the Secretary of State and lied us into war with Iraq. And that was, he was on my show just a few weeks ago. And so this is all about China. This is all, this has nothing to do, you know, if there's any benefits or mass death of Afghans because of this policy, that's all just collateral damage one way or the other. That's not what's going on here. This is the great game for dominance in Eurasia, where we, the U.S. government, has no business whatsoever.
All right, Scott, I'm going to give you a challenge as we wrap up. And the challenge is, I mean, I know you know everything there is to know, but here's the challenge. I want you to take 60 seconds. That's all you have, 60 seconds. And tell me, let's say you were in a debate, formal debate on this. You got a 60-second closing statement. Given what we heard in this post that I read at the beginning, I want you to summarize so that people can walk away with, who don't know all the details, but can walk away with a basic gut instinct, okay, this is the real truth of the matter. What is the real truth of the matter? What is the Scott Horton thesis in 60 seconds? Ready, go.
Well, standards of living have improved somewhat, but that's really beside the point. The numbers of people who wish the U.S. would stay only reflects the fact that the U.S. has built an unstable system that cannot stand on its own. This one always catches attention. The U.S. has spent far more, adjusted for inflation, and there's been a lot of inflation, Tom. Adjusted for inflation, the U.S. government has spent more on reconstruction and aid in Afghanistan than they spent on the Marshall Plan to rebuild all of Western Europe after World War II. And they've achieved absolutely nothing for it. The Special Inspector General for Afghan Reconstruction puts out his quarterly reports that are nothing but bad news on all fronts every 3 months. And people can look them up and read it and weep. I have a lot of the most important stats, I think, nailed down pretty well in my book, Fool's Errand, as well. And, you know, I'm not saying that everything will be fine if we leave. I'm saying everything will be a catastrophe if we leave. And that's because there's a massive distortion of power created by, well, first of all, U.S. paper money financing American military and State Department and financial intervention in their political economy. And that, yes, there's a correction coming and there's going to be hell to pay. But that ought to be, it is certainly to me, the reason to leave, the reason to call it quits now. Because this is the best the U.S. government can do, is make things worse, not better. And in fact, oh, let me also add, I know I'm over a minute.
You are so over. You would be kicked out of the debate stage.
Astrid Cerqui wrote this great book called Less is More, about how all of the help that the U.S. provides Afghanistan is counterproductive. Every bit of it, just like the federal government in your town, only much worse.
All right. I will accept this slightly bending the rules answer, but because you're Scott
Horton,
I'm
the worst, man. There's no, what are you going to do with the likes of me, you know?
But look, with almost no notice, I said, hey, Scott, you want to come on and talk about this? Yeah, of course I will. Yeah. All right, so listen, let me sum up here. You got to get Scott's book, Fool's Errand, because it's just fantastic. Oh, I have a lot of books. Yeah, but this book shows you how a book ought to be written. So foolserrand.us is actually the website for it. It'll also be linked at tomwoods.com/1260, which is the episode number for today. Visit Scott over at scotthorton.org. Got to listen to his show and support him as I do. I support Scott every single month. And when I get that automatic notification on my phone, you just sent your contribution to Scott Horton. That makes me feel good every month.
That's cool.
To
Thanks,
be able
ma'am.
To do that. I hope it makes you feel good to get the receiving end of that, but it makes me feel great.
Hey, did I tell you I'm at over 4,800 interviews now at scotthorton.org?
Oh, I was hoping you were going to say you're at over $4,800 in contributions per month, because you should be.
But, oh, that would be nice.
But that's an amazing figure.
I mean,
it makes my stupid 1,260 seem like nothing. But by the way, you're cheating. You're cheating because you've been doing like multiple interviews a day in a lot of those years. I mean, how can I keep up with that?
Yeah, well, there's a lot of bad news to cover, you know. It's not, you know, I got such a head start on you. You don't have to.
No, I know you were doing this before we even knew each other.
That's true. Yeah, I started.
I told the story last time about you doing that.
Archiving them. I mean, my first interviews were on Free Radio Austin back in 1998, but all those tapes are lost.
I remember
2003 is when I started posting them online and stuff. Yeah, so
I told the story last time. Then we really have to wrap up. I told the story last time about you hosting the weekend interview show. Uh-huh. And I would watch as everybody I knew got interviewed on that damn thing. Uh-huh. I'd say, why is Scott Horton? Does he have something against me? Like I really had this complex. Like what does he have against me that he won't have me on? And then finally I got the email. Do you want to come on the weekend interview show? And I thought, I've arrived.
Well, you got your revenge too, man, because I was just frustrated as hell for years. You wouldn't come on the show when I beg you so.
because kinds of things were going on. But
Let me say one more thing, man. Yeah. I know that this is no big deal to you, you know, probably anymore when this happens to you. But I get to share a stage with Ron Paul on November the 3rd. They're doing a thing down in Lake Jackson.
Oh, I didn't know you were going to be there.
Yeah, so it's Jeff Deist and Lou Rockwell, Ron Paul, yeah. Dan McAdams, Ron Unz, Deborah Medina, who I think ran for governor or something like that.
Yeah.
And myself there. I get to give a talk. So.
I didn't know you were going to be down there. Oh, that is absolutely great. It's
so tell your people.
Yeah, absolutely. Guys, go to Mises.org/events. You should go to that event. And if it weren't for the fact that I will have just returned from the Contra Cruise a week ago and I can't really go out again so soon, leave the family,
yeah.
I would love to go down there for that. But all you folks who are not so constrained should definitely look into that at Mises.org/events. All right, I got
to
run.
Warning to Jeff Deist right now that he wants me to talk about my own experience in media and whatever, but I'm just going to end up giving a speech about how much I love Ron Paul. You know that.
Yeah, it's hard to not give that speech. But anyway, thanks again, Scott. We'll talk soon.
Okay, thank you, Tom.
All right, folks, if you don't yet have my brand new free ebook, you got to grab it. It's called The Deregulation Boogeyman. You need this for when people tell you deregulation caused the financial crisis. You have to smack that down. You can't just say, no, it didn't, and then just walk away. You got to really, really smash this so that they feel it. Okay? They won't bring this up again with you, I promise. The Deregulation Boogeyman, you can grab it over at regulationmyths.com. I'll see you later.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.